And we have a few things that we're going to be kind of finishing up here. First with the Department of Forestry. So what I'm going to do is when I... we had scheduled a possible introduction of a committee measure. Members, we did not... there was a mix-up as far as the drafts were concerned. So that is something that we may reschedule for a later time, but we are going to scratch it off the agenda for today. So you can go ahead and take that off the agenda. We won't be doing that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you share with us the nature of the potential work session and the committee measure?
The measure was from the... a measure that Representative Berger had been working on during the interim with the group, and they wanted to introduce it as a committee measure, and I'm trying to remember now the absolute substance of it. And Jim?
It was for the Landscape Architect Board, and they were changing the renewal of licenses and some of the requirements. The difficulty there were two LC drafts. The wrong one was delivered to us, and we just discovered this yesterday when I faxed their administrator the draft that we were going to be working on, and found out we had the wrong draft. Thank you.
So, yeah, I couldn't remember that it was the Landscape Architect Board that, and some issues that were raised during the interim with the small agency reports that the Secretary of State's Audits Division did, and some issues that came up before the Joint Legislative Audits Committee. Okay, what we're going to do then is we're going to finish up. I'm going to open an informational meeting on the Oregon Department of Forestry, and where we ended last time, you'll remember, members, is that we had Clark Seeley from the Department of Forestry was here, along with Pam
Stovall.
Strobel. You know, I should remember that. Are you in any relation to Greg Strobel?
I am.
Okay. She says, anyway. So, Clark, why don't you and Pam go ahead and come forward, and we can wrap up with you. And I think that we can have this done in probably 30 minutes or less, because we were almost to the end on Thursday. I don't remember what day of the week this is. And Clark, did you have any other presentation that you wanted to make as far as the some of the responses relative to the audits division and the statewide comprehensive report?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Clark Seeley, the Associate State Forester for the Department of Forestry, and again, I'm joined by Pam Strobel, who's our internal auditor for the department. Mr. Chair, I do have just a few remarks that I could provide and a little bit of context and so forth, and I'd also, if the committee would permit me, I'd like to talk a little bit about where do we go from here in the context of this audit, as well as some other pieces. So
that would be terrific.
I can do that and certainly answer any questions you all have as well.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead then. Okay. And then we can ask questions at the end, or if something pops into your mind, then let me know, members.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Let me just touch briefly on a little bit of context about the Department of Forestry. I know that you all are familiar with us as an agency, but just a little bit by the numbers. We do have office locations across the state, and of course our central office is here in Salem. We have approximately 700 permanent employees and about 700 seasonal employees, most of which are in the fire protection program. Our biennial budget is approximately $220 million per biennium. We process about 250,000 financial transactions per year, not including payroll, and that's about 21,000 per month. There are high points and low points in terms of that processing, of course, with fire protection and the state forest program being our two largest operating programs. And they have seasonality to their work, of course, and so those transactions ebb and flow throughout the year. Our business services section in the department includes fiscal services, payroll, procurement, property, equipment, facilities, and budget and management. And that section is all part of our agency administration program, which also includes information systems, human resources, agency affairs, resource planning, and agency leadership. Now, the fiscal services unit, which, of course, is most intimately a part of our financial work in this particular audit, includes 13 employees, one manager, and 12, made up of one manager and 12 accountants and accounting technicians. And we basically centralize our accounting work and fiscal work within the agency, even though our field offices often generate initial documents in terms of purchase orders and requisitions. All of our actual accounting function is centralized here in Salem. The payroll function is also centrally staffed with two permanent positions here in Salem and a manager who oversees payroll as well as several other aspects of business services. And then we have approximately 25 office specialists around the state in our field organization who do the time capture and the initial entry of payroll information and coding into the state payroll system. So I just want to provide that little bit of context for you this morning and appreciate the opportunity to do that. Let me now move, if I could, to just a couple of points in the audit results in our response, and I know that we'll not need to walk through the entire response today. The audit itself, of course, was covered by the Audits Division last Thursday quite well, and we don't need to walk through the complete document, but again, I'd be glad to answer any questions. I do have a couple of points I wanted to make, though. There were some questions last Thursday initially about the accounts that had been audited this fiscal 04 period. There were 22 accounts, and the audit amount is somewhere in the neighborhood of $286 million. The two accounts that were of interest particularly mentioned was account 0065, which is unreconciled deposit. That's the first account shown in the list. And then secondly is account 0503, which is a little bit farther down the list, and that's the accounts receivable, other unbilled. Let me just comment on what both of those accounts are, and I am not an accountant, but I'll give you my knowledge from our accounting staff. 0065, the unreconciled deposit, is essentially the entry point for cash and receivables into the Department of Forestry. That's where the money first lands, so to speak, in the state accounting system, and it's held there for a period of days until our accounting folks then can receipt it and move it into the proper SFMS account. So it literally represents the first entry point of cash into the agency. And again, the money and cash sits there until it can be receipted and moved through. Again, that's typically anywhere from 5 to 7 business days, depending on the time of year and our transaction load and just getting through the transactions that need to be dealt with. From that point, then, the money moves to 0070, which is the cash on deposit with the treasurer. So that's the essence of that first account. And then 0503, accounts receivable, other unbilled. Those are accounts receivable projections that we make at the end of each fiscal year based upon knowledge we have of receivables that should be coming to us, but for which we don't have final amounts determined to bill. And so they reside in this 0503 account rather than 0501, which is the actual billed accounts receivable. And then once we're able to have, or once we receive the information and can make a final determination of the actual amount, then of course it becomes an account receivable billed. In the case of fiscal 04, the dollar amount that's shown in the report is primarily, in this category, is primarily the catastrophic fire insurance payments that we receive from the insurance carrier and in this case, to cover claims we made to the insurance carrier for the fire seasons of 2002 and 2003, which had extraordinary costs and did, in fact, have claims to the insurance in both of those years. So at the end of the fiscal 04, we placed a dollar amount in this other unbilled category to represent the claims we had made to the insurance companies not yet received. Now, we actually received payment on these claims from the insurance companies in October of 2004 after all of the work was done that needed to be done for that. So I just wanted to explain those two accounts briefly. Just a couple of comments on two of the conditions. The first is the late insurance.
Representative Butler?
If I may, Clark, thank you, Mr. Chair. When you closed those accounts out in October of 2004 for the 2003 and 2002 claims that had been in the unbilled, were there then differences? I understand that was about $1 million that was that were left in the accounts, unbilled accounts receivable for those 2 years of claims for prior fires. Were there differences that had to be reconciled and adjusted out, and were they in fact adjusted out in October?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, you're correct. They do have to be adjusted. The agency submits claims to the insurance companies for the costs that we incur for catastrophic fire that meet both the legal thresholds as well as the insurance policy thresholds.
Mr. Chair, I don't think I'll take Clark through the mechanics of it. My concern is, and where I'm going with this, Clark, is that once the adjustment is made, who is authorized to make the adjustment? So if I have $1 million in the account for the 2002 and 2003 claims, and they're received, and that's in June of 2004. They are subsequently received in October of 2004, and I receive $800,000. Who is authorized then to go in and adjust? First of all, I want to know that it is being done, and number two, who is authorized and what is the procedure for making the adjustment for the unreceived other unbilled amounts that are now no longer in question as to whether or not they will ever be received?
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, the answer to your first part of the question is yes, we do make those adjustments. I can't answer the second part of your question in detail in terms of the process, but our fiscal manager in our fiscal services unit oversees the change and the correction of those accounts with the State Controller's Division, and we ensure that those are made according to the State Controller Division policy. I can research that further for you and be glad to do that, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason that I'm following this line of question is there's been an indication in the audit report that there are some internal control deficiencies. That then leaves an opportunity for potential for rife problems in this regard relative to adjusting or writing down accounts if you don't have the proper internal control procedures. I think, you know, you can carry that to its logical conclusion, how items may be written off that were received in other gratuitous forms, and I'm sure that never happens, but I'm anxious that there be a policy and a procedure followed, and that it is. And I appreciate that you're working with the Human Resource Division or the Controllers Division, rather, Department of Administrative Services. But I just like to have someone confirm on the record that policy is in place and it is followed, and the prescribed policy is laid out and that it's followed carefully. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I'd be glad to provide additional information to the committee and Representative Butler on that to assure that.
I think that would be good.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Since we've got you stopped for a second, Clark, sure. I have just a quick question, and that is with regards to the receivables, other unbilled, and you stated that it's primarily catastrophic insurance that's yet to be received, but that claims have been made for. What I'm curious about that is that why would you not go ahead and show that as a billed billed account receivable once the claim has actually been made?
Mr. Chair, I believe that we do. It's just that the moment in time or the point in time that the fiscal 04 audit amounts are shown on the audits division letter We had not received payments from the insurance companies at this point in time.
And you had not made claim at that point?
We had made claim, but we had not received the money.
Okay.
And so they stayed in other unbilled. Those claims, as we had estimated them and submitted them, remained in the as unbilled category until we received the money.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
If I could just move to condition number four, internal controls over accounts receivable. I think that because of the nature of the dollars that are mentioned in the audit report, I just wanted to briefly comment on the findings and reference to our fire suppression cost collection process and briefly describe that. This is on page 11 and 12 of our response. The Department of Forestry, as you know, is responsible for forest fire protection on about 16 million acres of forest land in the state, most of which is private ownership and some state and federal lands. Every fire that we take action on, we investigate for cause, and cause is generally either lightning or some human-caused fire. When we determine that the fire is human-caused, then we go through a series of steps that leads us to a conclusion of whether or not there is a responsible party under the law for the cost of suppression of that fire. And in some circumstances and under some conditions, primarily related to negligence or malicious use of fire, arson, the law, state law, provides the ability for us to collect the cost of suppression of those types of fires. Now, that could range anywhere from a couple hundred dollars in the case of a very small fire with a small response, up to several million dollars for a large fire that involves a full response. Whenever we reach that point of conclusion in terms of responsible party, then we begin a process of cost collection that's defined in our policies that steps us through a series of initial demands for payment of those costs. And we go through a series of three demand payments, if necessary, for the initial collection. If at the point of the third demand we've not received payment of the fire suppression costs, then we move that case over to the Department of Justice, the Civil Enforcement Division, who we've worked with for many years and developed a process with them to carry that claim forward. The Civil Enforcement Division takes the claim at that point and moves forward, either again making demand to the responsible party, or if in the case of a significant fire, begins to work with the responsible party and possibly the legal system in terms of process. Most of our large fires, because of cost, do work their way into the legal system. Department of Justice, of course, carries that for us and with us. And we end up ultimately either being able to recover costs in full or in part, or we settle the case for some amount that's possible under settlement, or in the case of some fires, based on advice of Department of Justice, the costs are written off and not collected. In all cases, though, what I would say to you is that we do run our cost collection process as fully and completely as possible, and working with Department of Justice, run those cases. At any moment in time, we'll have anywhere from 100 to 200 open cases, again ranging from the small couple hundred dollar cases to multi-million dollar cases. And we're continually working those cases, and month to month, working cases with Department of Justice. I think the important element in terms of the audit finding is that as we move those cases through, can we make improvements in our process with Department of Justice? And we continually look for improvements. Frankly, the Department of Justice is the Civil Enforcement Division have been excellent to work with, particularly over the last 15 years. We actually, many years ago, used to work all of our cost collection through the Criminal Division, and we had statutory authority to do that. But the civil enforcement approach has actually been much more effective for us, and we'll continue to do that. Wherever we can make improvements to that process, we will do that, and based on the audit this year, we'll go back and work with the Department of Justice on that. The one element that's mentioned in the audit report that we do want to explore further is the ability to include interest in the demand. We do include interest in the demand once it reaches the Department of Justice level, and they take it from there, but we'll explore the possibility of interest in our initial free demand process within the Department of Forestry. And
Clark, before you go on with that, I understood what you said with regards to you would include interest in your three demand system. So are you suggesting then that from the outset you would start working to collect interest, or are you saying that after you've made the demand for payment, they haven't paid, they have 60 days or whatever the case may be, they haven't paid, at that point you're going to start trying to at that point you would start adding the interest? I just want to make sure that I'm clear and understand what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, I think frankly I don't know the answer to that question yet, because we haven't talked that through with Department of Justice in terms of what's possible under both state law as well as state controller division policy for application of interest. But once we have that sorted out, then we'll see where can we first apply interest on an outstanding collection, and begin at that point and move forward.
Okay.
And I don't know whether that is not likely to be in the first demand, but certainly in the second and third demand. At some point, I think that comes into play.
Yeah, I was just thinking that in the first demand, it wouldn't necessarily make sense to be charging interest, because
Nothing occurred at that point.
All intents and purposes, don't know that they owe anything yet. Well, they maybe do, but they're going to claim that they don't. And so, and I think that if I have pulled the right statute, now if I can find it, I believe that the state law says that after, here it is. And I think if I've got the right one, ORS 477.068 talks about liability for cost abatement, and it says that after, I believe it's 60 days, that when a bill has been due, then interest can be added. And also there's a time at which it says if actual cost is not paid within such a 90-day period, such amount shall bear interest at 10%. So there's that, and then I think there's also in the statute that allows you to use either the Department of Revenue or the Department of Administrative Services for trying to collect those and for adding interest and that sort of thing. And then of course you can always go to the private sector as far as a collection agency is concerned if those avenues fail.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct, and you have cited the right statute.
Okay,
and our current process moves us through our first three demands within that 90-day period, and then moves, if not successful, then moves us to the Department of Justice beyond that, where we do begin the interest calculation. But we're talking about interest earlier in the process,
okay,
possibly as well.
Okay. Good. Good. Okay.
Okay. The other condition that I wanted to speak to just briefly again with you this morning is condition number 6. And again, wanted to let you know, I believe I mentioned this last Thursday, but again, wanted you to know that relating to that condition, both with respect to employee recognition as well as employee moving and relocation, we did meet, the staff of the agency did meet 2 weeks ago with the staff of both the Department of Administrative Services, State Controllers Division, and Human Resources Division to specifically look at those two topics. We looked at our audit findings, we looked at our current policy, and we looked at state policy in all respects. And we confirmed out of that our current agency policy is in compliance and consistent with state policy with respect to employee relocation and moving. And so, from the standpoint of policy match and compliance, our policy is there. Now, that's not to say that our procedures are not in need of improvement, and we know they are, and we're committed to making improvements in our own process and procedures. And we also acknowledge the error that we did make that was identified in the audit with respect to the move that was identified. We also, though, out of that meeting on the second topic, have acknowledged and understand that our recognition policy is not consistent with state policy. The State Controller's Division staff did provide me with a clarification of that by email last week, and we'll be able to use that then to modify our employee recognition policy, and we'll do that within the next month and be able to get our own current policy in line with state policy. So I just wanted to again touch on those two, knowing that those are important and of interest. Let me just, if I could, Mr. Chair, then briefly touch on where do we go from here from the department standpoint and our actions and plans from this point. And it really falls into two categories, I think, for today that I'll speak to. One is improvements in internal controls, and the other is improvement in business systems. In terms of improvement to internal controls, again, as we have said, our detailed action plan that we'll develop in response to the fiscal 04 audit will be finalized in the next month or so, and we'll implement that through the course of the next year, including correcting the errors that we've made and changing policy and procedures where we need to. Several actions have already occurred, and several have been completed in terms of the recommendations and findings from the audit. We do have remaining work to do, and we've established deadlines ranging anywhere from next month, March, through December of this year. And we will monitor our progress internally with PAM and our internal audit function, as well as the agency executive team, and I'll be leading the effort to do that. Again, we met 2 weeks ago with the Department of Administrative Services staff, and that was very helpful for us in looking and making changes. Also, in the spring of 2004, now just about a year ago, we instituted a system to monitor compliance internally, particularly in the areas of payroll, fiscal management, and purchasing. And what we've done is our central staff in Salem are getting out and meeting for a day or two with our field offices around the state, conducting field office visits and reviews based on a checklist that has been developed, and then establishing written findings and corrective actions based on those reviews. Our staff comes back and prepares findings and corrective actions. And we're in process now with those. We completed 13 payroll reviews around the state so far. We'll continue to do that this coming year, and we'll be able to get around the state in all of our field offices in both payroll and fiscal standards during this year, 2005. That'll set us up for a continual process of follow-up based upon that.
Clark, before you go on, could you provide the committee with a copy of the checklist that you're referring to? I think that would be helpful for us to
be glad to. Okay.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Clark, you're in the process of wrapping up, so I'm just going to ask a couple of questions. First of all, thank you for delivering me down kind of the history of the issues relative to relocation expenses. And as I went through the relocation history, I came across a number of issues. I tried to chronologize the areas. Let me just give you three levels of things that you're faced with. I'm not telling you anything that you don't know. And I'll ask this from Department of Administrative Services as well. But you've got policies and procedures established. Collective bargaining agreement, and then we've got rules, administrative rules, executive department administrative rules. Of those three, when I've got conflicting policy and procedure manual statement that conflicts with the collective bargaining agreement that may conflict with the rules, when I've got three different kinds of documents, which of those do you follow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the state law, of course, supersedes all elements of what you've described. And so if there is established state law that applies, then that comes first. Secondly, and again, I'll defer certainly to the Department of Administrative Services folks, but secondly would be collective bargaining language if, in fact, it is specific to a policy and modifies a state policy. And then administrative rules come into play beyond that. So law, collective bargaining agreements, administrative rules, and then I would add simply a fourth to us, and that is agency policy.
Policy and procedures.
If there is agency policy, then that comes into play. Certainly our intent, of course, is for our agency policy to be consistent with all the other levels up the line. But that's our approach.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up on that, if I may. So then, Clark, would it be fair to say that each agency, or at least with regard to the Department of Forestry, is pretty much left to develop its own policies and procedures?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, do you mean specifically with regard to the moving policy or just in general?
With regard to the Oregon Accounting Manual that appears to be by rule, but then to implement it, the policy procedure process, is there a separate manual for how to implement the policy and procedure that's developed by rule?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we do have agency policy, written policy established in what we call directive. Those directives, though, form or have as their foundation either Oregon Accounting Manual rules or, in the case of human resources, HRSD policy, Human Resource Division policy. And so while we may have internal directive and policy that is more specific to our operation, and particularly with respect to outlining who is responsible for what within that policy, we do that. We don't necessarily duplicate or be redundant with Oregon Accounting Manual work, but again, where we need to prescribe particularly who's responsible for what action under our policy, that's what we do within our own directive system.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I could just insert an item here, so you have the rules, then you have the policy, and then if there's a collective bargaining agreement that slipped in that process, how then do you go about the changing of the policy and procedures?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we certainly then have to consider what does the collective bargaining language say with respect to the policy in our agency, and be in line with that if necessary. Now, that also says to us that there certainly is the opportunity every 2 years to open up contract language and consider changes in the contract. And in the case of the moving policy in particular, I'll say that our current moving policy that is part of the SEIU collective bargaining contract is embedded within the contract as a letter of agreement, rather than a full article of the contract. The importance there is simply that the letters of agreement, at least in this case, sunset. They sunset with that current contract. And the letters of agreement only carry forward beyond the current contract if both parties agree. And so there is the ability, from management perspective, there is the ability to reconsider collective bargaining language that is in letters of agreement that doesn't necessarily require a full article opening within the contract.
Mr. Chair, I just would express that I'm just a little bit anxious as I follow some of the history going back 15 years on this or longer on this particular issue, that this changing of policies and procedures by an agency around the bargaining contracts, collective bargaining contracts, around the other evolving issues in state government might be a little too loose, but I guess that's a question that we'll ask from the Department of Administrative Services if they feel that we have a tight enough policy and procedure program there around the Oregon Accounting Manual, and then what happens when we have the collective bargaining agreements inserted in that process, and whether or not they're responsive to that. So, but I do appreciate the history that you provided me from the information background, and I tried to, as I say, I tried to chronologize that. I can see why that would be somewhat, it would be difficult to follow it sometimes. So I appreciate that history of information. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Did you have a question, mm-hmm. Representative Rosenbaum? Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, you know, you obviously cannot change things that have happened in the past, but one of the most disturbing things has been the fact that things have occurred that have been cited before. So what I want to ask you, with things that you've laid out and the plans for the future, can you assure us that we're not going to be coming back in a year or 2 years and looking again at a new audit and seeing some of these same things occurring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, we have been on, this is our third annual financial audit with the Secretary of State's office, and we have been on what we believe is a process of continual improvement over these past 3 years to correct actions that require immediate correction that they've identified, and we've done those, and then to again work on our policy, procedure, training, and communication internally to make improvements as we've gone along, and we'll continue to we'll continue in that mode to work that way. We have, just as an example, we identified 48 internal policies relative to fiscal services and payroll that needed to be updated, revised, and reviewed, updated, and revised. And we now are nearly complete with 30 of those, and we have plans to finish that work and have incorporated that into our response by the end of this year, by the end of 2005. Similarly, we have 70 processes that we've identified that also need to be examined and reviewed, and we've completed a review on 40 of those, and again, we'll have those completed by the end of 2005. So I think that the key is that we are committed to making improvements as we go along, and we'll continue to do that as we've stated in our response. I think that the timing and so forth, sequence of audit work is important to keep in mind, simply that because the audit occurs over the course of 4 or 5 months into a fiscal year, when we get our audit work done a year from now for fiscal 05, there may be some findings that are identified from July of last year through the fall of last year through November, December, that may reflect the old history, but we are committed to making improvements, and those will be carried forward to the next year.
Follow-up, Mr.
Follow-up, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. I mean, I appreciate that explanation. I'm just not sure that's an answer to what I'm asking. Now, I understand if things have occurred that will be picked up in the future, you can't do anything about that, but going forward from there, can you assure us that the steps that you're taking will have dealt with this problem and we won't be looking again at similar results from that point forward?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I can assure you that we will do all of the work we need to do based on the Secretary of State's audit recommendations and our response, and as complete an effort as we can make to address all of those points will be made. Our plan is to complete that work between now and the end of this calendar year, the end of 2005. But again, the audit for this new year, for fiscal 05, which started last July, will begin in June or July of this coming year, and they'll be looking back and they'll see some of what we have improved and changed, and they'll likely see some of what was in the past as well, because they're looking over those first 3 or 4 months of this current fiscal year as they look. So we will make all of the changes that we have identified, but it's a matter of getting the process completed over time, and that does take some time. We are fully committed, though. I can assure you of that.
Thank you. Thanks.
You're welcome. Are there other questions? Clark, I have a couple of things that I would like to just point out, and I appreciate your comments this morning. With regards to the reportable condition number two, the controls over cash handling, one of the statements that's in your written response on page three, it says that we disagree in part with the finding, we agree that there's room for improvement, but we do have policies and procedures in place covering handling cash handling. I think I brought up the question before, is whether or not they were actually being, your policies are actually being used or adhered to by your staff. And from some of the recommendations and some of the issues that were brought up by the audits division, that question remains open. One of the things that I would like to see you develop along with that are consequences for when cash is not handled correctly. I think that and whether it's be consequences to the employees themselves or consequences to the management for not adhering to the policies, but I think that there needs to be some consequences added in there, because I have many times said, and this is because I was talking to a cash register dealer many years ago before I opened my own coffee store, and one of the comments that he made is that the first step between honesty and dishonesty is opportunity. And what he was trying to sell me on, of course, was the cash register that he wanted to sell me because it was the best and had the most, you know, bells and whistles and the most security. And the same sort of a thing, I think, applies here. We hire people, we know they're honest, but you know what? The first step is the opportunity. And we don't need to be creating the opportunity for them. So that's one thing that I would like to just point out. Another thing that I wanted to point out is that in your response letter dated January 31, you were talking about that many, in the last paragraph of the letter, on the front page of the letter, it says, in fact, many, halfway through, it says, in fact, many of the findings listed in your final report were items the department itself brought forward and identified that it needed to improve upon. And my comment to myself there was discovery. And what I would like to see the department do is that when you discover that there's issues, besides bringing it forward to the auditors, is really take that step. And I think that with having hired Ms. Strobel in that internal auditing position, maybe that will help the department in that way. But I would really, that's something that I would really like to see the department kind of make sure that you're following is to get those things discovered. And then the last comment that I would make is that at this particular point is that with regards to the to item number six, you've identified a couple of things where there might be a conflict. I've gone back and looked at some of the material as well relative to the Oregon Administrative Manual and the bargaining agreement that you have and that sort of thing, and see that there would be some areas for conflict. But I think one of the things that we'll end up doing later on is encouraging the Department of Administrative Services to make sure that the OAM is up to date, or however that's and it looks like the latest version that I saw regarding particularly employee moving and recognition does leave a little more latitude to the department. But I think that, you know, common sense makes a lot of sense. But they also have what it looks like to me are model suggestions. I can tell you, let me go switch over to the Department of Justice for just a second. When the Attorney General puts out model rules for compliance with, you know, XYZ law, I can tell you that local governments, cities, counties, special districts, our agencies, pretty much look at that and say, you know what, maybe what we'll do is we'll just adopt that. There might be a few changes that we're going to make it completely applicable to our particular situation, but we're going to basically adopt all of the criteria and that sort of thing. When the Department of Administrative Services puts out to the agencies model rules, if you will, with regards to moving recognition and those sorts of things. I think it behooves the agencies to look very carefully at that and to basically follow the criteria that have been laid out in the latest version. Now, I recognize that that could mean that, you know, you're constantly changing pages in your administrative manual, but I think that that's something that will help keep you the most up to date. Lastly, members, I am going to suggest that we send a letter over to the Ways and Means folks so that some things can be followed with regard via budget notes and with regards to some other, you know, some other actions. And one of the big things that I think we ought to recommend, and I will have a draft for you to ratify on Thursday. But one of the things that I think that we ought to recommend, and this is to help the department kind of getting through some of these things that have shown up, some of them three times over the last 3 years, being continual issues with regards to audits, is that on a quarterly basis, when the Joint Legislative Audits Committee is meeting, that I would think that the Department of Forestry should come forward and should be invited to attend those meetings and make a report to the Joint Legislative Audits Committee with regards to what sorts, you know, how they're doing, what the progress is that's being made. That way, if there's further corrective action that needs to be that is at that point discovered and needs to be taken up, the audits committee, the joint audits committee, can make that recommendation to the department. And if there's a need for money to be attached to that, they could certainly make the recommendation for the scheduling of the funds through the emergency board. And I think that would be a good way to follow along on this so that we can help the department stay in compliance with what the state law is and some of this administrative burden, and give you an outlet for being able to report issues that are coming up, so that this doesn't come back, you know, as Representative Rosenbaum pointed out, in 2 years, that you're not coming back and saying, well, you know, yeah, and I know that it's been an issue for the last, now it's been 5 years, but we're getting there. You know, I think getting you there is the important thing, and then once you're there, is keeping you there, so that you are in compliance, so that these issues don't keep raising their ugly head. So with that, okay. So. That's all I have. Are there any other questions or comments or anything? And I'll have a draft letter for the members on Thursday. So thank you very much again,
Mr. Chair. Thank you, and thank you, members of the committee. We appreciate a lot. The audit is always an important tool for us, and we know that we have improvements to make, and we're glad to make those improvements with you all. And Mr. Chair, if I could just say that your points. To me and to us, the Department of Forestry, with respect to the consequences and discovery and model rules are all well taken, and we'll take those back and talk about those as we modify and change our own policy.
Okay.
And again, we'd be glad to work with the Joint Interim Committee as we progress over the next year as well. Be glad to.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us again today. Okay, now, members, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Department of Forestry. I'm going to open an informational hearing on the Department of Administrative Services. We had posed some questions to the department a couple of weeks ago. And we have with us today Lori Warner, who is prepared to respond to all of the questions. And as you can see, we are getting a copy of Gone with the Wind. Oh, no, it's not Gone with the Wind.
That's your request.
It's from the Department of Administrative Services.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the Acting Director for Department of Administrative Services. John Radford, the State Controller, and Sue Wilson, who is the Administrator for the Human Resource Services Division, are here. And I didn't know if you wanted to follow up with any of the questions you raised in the forestry audit before I got started today, or if you're going to do that at a later time.
Representative Butler?
Mr. Chair, I think that it would be appropriate for John Radford to respond to some of the concerns that we've raised, particularly with regard to the Oregon Accounting Manual. And I, for one, would like to have an opportunity before we get into the questions that previously were given to Interim Director Warner that we take a look at some of the issues.
Okay. We can do that.
Chair Crumble, members of the committee, my name is John Radford, State Controller, State Controller's Division, Department of Administrative Services. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I need to know, particularly as we look at some of the issues that we've just gone through, I assume that you followed some of the issues with regard to the Department of Forestry. The concern that I have I think it's evidenced in some of the issues that have come out here that the Oregon Accounting Manual seems to have rules in it. It seems to have policy and procedure laid out. I'm not sure how much of that is within the statutes or whether it's just by rule. And then finally, there seems to be some policy as it goes from department to department. Perhaps you could just let us know how a department goes about developing its own policy and procedures in relationship to the Oregon Accounting Manual, how often the Oregon Accounting Manual is changed, and how that is communicated out to the various department heads, and make sure that we get the water to the end of the row with regard to what happens in Salem, and how the folks in Vail, Oregon implement that.
Sure, you bet. Chair Cromwell, members of the committee, the Oregon Accounting Manual consists of, I'm going to say some 50 or 60, maybe 70 policies regarding various accounting and financial management activities and functions across the state. What we do, this is also just generally financial management principles that are recognized and adopted generally, plus we get guidance from the Governmental Accounting Standards Board with respect to accounting standards and financial reporting standards. These accounting policies are not created in a vacuum. Generally, if it's a complex policy, we have a team of professionals from the agencies sit down with us and go over the policy. There are numerative, iterative drafts of the policy that we create. We create a first draft. It goes out to the state agencies, primarily the financial accounting, financial reporting, accounts payable kinds of, wherever the policy, whatever areas of government that it's touching, goes out to those people for reviews. Those reviews come back. We synthesize the recommendations, the recommended changes, that kind of thing. We may create a second draft, send that out for review and comment. We get those comments back. We might even do a third draft depending upon the nature of the policy and substantive characteristics of it with respect to implementation. Keep in mind that we're trying to drive a balance between policies that give agencies some flexibility in some areas, and then we have some areas that we want absolute and 100% compliance, and there's no question that we want this particular policy implemented or procedure followed. And so they'll be fairly prescriptive in nature. So we're trying to balance that line as well as deal with agencies the size of ODOT and Department of Human Resources, as well as what I like to say the Tattoo Commission, which might be a person or two. So we're trying to balance those kinds of perspectives as we draft the policies. But they're not drafted in a vacuum. They're drafted with the full participation of those who are going to have to implement the policies at the agency level.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, then, John, what you're telling us is that each time there is any change to these 90 sections or whatever there are in the Oregon Accounting Manual, the same process of notification, hearings, opportunity to comment, and the periods could be, depending upon the numbers of times that it this is it possible to get 8 or 10 of these rules under some morph at some time, or is it you follow through with one item and close it out and then start on another item as dictates?
Some could be, Chair Crumbel, members of the committee, some could be concurrently. For example, let's say we have a policy in fixed assets would be particularly of interest to those who are doing the fixed asset function out in the agencies. Concurrently, we might have a policy change that's addressing accounts receivable areas. So there could be a policy out there that two policies at once. Generally, that's not the case. Generally, it's one or two policies every 6 months or so. We're not talking about a heavy number of changes here. I'm going to say maybe on average year, we probably update or create 3 to 6 policies. 3 to 6 changes.
So
in a year's time.
Go ahead. Six changes or new policies.
Generally, not new policies. Generally, maybe one or two new policies. Even if that, sometimes there's we go by a year there are no new policies. But generally, maybe speaking, I'm going to say 3 to 6 policy changes a year, where we've taken a policy and redrafted it. We could get audit recommendations. Here, I'll tell you how the process works. If we see that there's a problem, and we get a lot of good information from the Secretary of State's audits area in this area. So if we've got a policy out there that's unclear because we're seeing 2 or 3 or 4 agencies that are having problems with it, then we need to make some clarity. There's an interpretation problem, and we need to maybe provide some examples, or we need to restructure the language to add more clarity because we see 2 or 3 or 4 agencies having problems. If it's just one agency, it's one isolated incident, that may not generate a revamp of the policy or a redo of the policy. Could just be that agency that's having a problem.
So, Mr. Chair, if I can follow up on, so you go through the same notice, the same comment opportunity for each rulemaking, then how do you follow up with regard to individual agencies' compliance with regard to, for instance, the relocation policy or compensation policy or other internal control cash handling policy that we've talked about today?
The relocation and the compensation would be an HRSD policy. That's different from the Oregon Accounting Manual. The Oregon Accounting Manual focuses on financial activities. Relocation is a recruitment and retention policy, and that would be an HRSD, Human Resources Services Division, and compensation would be in that division as well. But just on the Oregon Accounting Manual, generally we have training sessions. If it's a particularly complex policy, we'll have a training session or two to cover the changes or the complexity. If it's a very simple policy and we expect the financial controllers out there or the senior financial accountants out there to understand and to apply that, if it's a relatively simple change, we won't undertake a lot of training. But so far we haven't had very much problems in that area.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when I see something that says Executive Department Issuing Division Budget and Management relative to special travel expenses, that would be a Human Resource Services Division manual item.
Now, travel, reimbursement for travel, for example, reimbursement for meals and lodging, airfare, that kind of thing, that falls under an accounts payable umbrella, and that would be our policy for travel.
So that would be Human Resource Services Division.
No, that would be us. That would be us because we're...
Gas?
Us as in State Controllers Division OAM policy. I'm sorry.
So State Controllers. So, yeah. So there is a separate manual. I just need to get these clear, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure which manual I'm reading from right now. There's an Oregon Accounting Manual, and those are with regard to accounting policies. But then with regard to travel, that would be a...
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Representative Butler, that would fall within the Oregon Accounting Manual.
Okay.
I have if you'd like, I could pass out an index of what is contained in the Oregon Accounting Manual.
You know, that would be real helpful if you want to just go ahead and give it.
This would be very helpful for a discussion, I'm sure.
Sure.
And then I understand there's also a Human Resource Services Division manual as well. Mr. Radford identified that special travel expenses, I guess what I'm trying to go through is special travel expenses, relocation, employee recognition and honoring employees. Those policies are developed from by whom, what's the consistency in developing those? Are they communicated statewide or department-wide within departments? What notice, comment period, and those kinds of things are given?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative Butler, for the record, my name is Sue Wilson. I'm Administrator of the Human Resource Services Division in the Department of Administrative Services. Our division is responsible for some of those policies that you have been referring to related to relocation and other things related specifically and directly to employees. For a little bit of clarification, Human Resource Services Division goes through a very similar process as John Radford described. When we are doing a policy change, those policies, we bring in a group of human resource professionals from the agencies, we talk about the policies, we determine if there are issues, and we then draft new language, put that out for comment, have it reviewed by the Attorney General's office, and then implement those policies. There are a variety of elements that make human resource policies more challenging than others, some of which we talked about this morning. Most of the policies that we adopt relate specifically to management service, unrepresented, unclassified employees, if there is any provision in a collective bargaining contract that speaks to that same issue. So collective bargaining contracts are the governing work for an agency in relation to its represented employees. Human Resource Service Division's policies, if there is no collective bargaining contract on that specific issue, then we may have a policy that affects all state employees. If the bargaining contract speaks to it, then ours just speaks to management service, unrepresented and unclassified.
Now, Mr. Chair, make sure I understand. This is with regard to the Human Resource Service Division that Sue is referring to, and then what of the State Comptroller's Manual relative to travel expenses? Because I can imagine that a collective bargaining agreement would have issues relative to the importance of employees traveling. So who supersedes that? Does that come from your operation of Shop Sewer? Does that come back through Mr. Radford's and through the development of the Oregon Accounting Manual? Or tell me what the process is of selecting. I've got a lot of decisions that are being made here, and sometimes I could be following a decision to reimburse for relocation and be in violation of a contract or be in violation of another directive from somewhere within the Department of Administrative Services.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, it is confusing. And because of the contracts and what areas they might cover or not cover, we have to constantly sort of be working with the human resource divisions to help them interpret what applies where. In the case of travel policy, for the most part, most of our contracts have language which says we adopt the Oregon Administrative, the Oregon Accounting Manual policy related to travel. For our larger contracts, that is the case. So that means that they will go with what is currently in the Oregon Accounting Manual. We have a few situations where there may be letters of agreement with a particular union or a particular location where they may have some different language related to travel.
Hello.
In that case, the contract supersedes.
Okay, let me interrupt you, Sue. Representative Butler?
So I appreciate the fact that you're when you do have a collective bargaining agreement, that certainly that would be the governing instrument in that regard. My concern is then how do you ensure that each agency is in compliance with a system which you've admitted is in fact confusing? How do you administer that? How do you check it out so that we don't get these in audit findings that each manager or each department is following that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we do have an audit function within the Human Resource Services Division. It is limited, and we do take on certain areas that we do try to look at. We also have, I guess there is a natural process in place related to contract language, where if an agency isn't following contract language, then the employees do have the right to file a grievance. And that grievance process allows us to take a look at what's happening within the application of that particular contract language.
Mr. Chair, my hope would be that certainly we don't arrive at the grievance process in this process, that we would follow first of all, the collective bargaining agreement and allow it to govern. But when it is silent, I guess I'm concerned about this audit function within the Human Resource Services Division that makes certain that each state agency statewide is in compliance with travel or relocation. Maybe Mr. Redford.
Mr. Redford, I think, has a comment about
Chair
that.
Crummell, Representative Butler, members of the committee, when an employee fills out a travel voucher and submits a claim, the accounts payable unit at the individual agency pre-audits that claim, and they pre-audit it against our policies. If they have a letter of agreement with a particular union or a particular provision of a union contract that takes precedence, they will have that information. It's unique to that agency. So those accounts payable people out there are pre-auditing that claim. If there's a problem with the claim, they'll deny it or they'll send it back for additional documentation or support or whatever they have to do to process that claim. So that's the first line of defense there. Second line of defense would be if an agency has an internal auditor, and as a part of the risk assessment for that agency, if this rises to the level of audit coverage, they will likely do some kind of an audit during the year or maybe during the biennium against a certain set of transactions. That's the second layer of protection. And the third layer would be any audits that, any transactions that might come to review during a Secretary of State audit at the agency.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, I could ask then, is there a statewide basic policy from which we can begin that's produced by DAS regarding that's uniform statewide that applies in Adrian as well as Scappoose that deals with relocation, that deals with employee retirement, that's promulgated by the Department of Administrative Service and would be a uniform policy statewide, assuming that the collective bargaining agreement for those represented employees doesn't supersede it, or that I guess that would be the only thing that should supersede it at that point. Maybe you could...
Chair Crummell, Representative Butler, members of the committee. When I was just speaking a few seconds ago, I was talking about the travel policy. Now, when we're talking about employee relocation, that's an HR policy, and I believe they have that documented in the policy. Yeah, that is uniformly applied across the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, in relation to the relocation policy was adopted, I believe, in 1999, and what it does is it does set out model rules for agencies. It requires that each agency have a relocation policy. It does not require that policy be run by DAS. It allows an agency to establish its own policy. Again, the model policy is given there, but there is nothing that indicates that it has to be followed. We do have some HR policies statewide, which are statewide policies, as John indicated. These are the policies. We have others where they are considered more guidelines. At the time this one was adopted, it was felt that it was better to do it as a model policy.
Mr. Chair, I think Sue just really landed on it at that point, and that is there is not a statewide policy that basically each agency, and I hope it's agency-wide, that it would be uniform at that point, can come up with its own particular policy, even though there may be a HR policy, as Sue calls it. I assume that's Human Resource Services Division, is that one? Okay. That is a stated policy from 1999, did you say, Sue? If it's a 1999 policy on as from Human Resources, but that each agency then develops its own relocation policy, then I'm wondering if the other issues related to special travel expenses, which are from the State Comptroller's Manual, or the Employee Retirement. Now, which manual does that come from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I just as a thought here in terms of stepping back a little from it, you can see DAS's position on establishing in some areas where it's very prescriptive and some areas where there's more flexibility. And over time, the philosophies of both the legislature and the governor about how much control DAS and how prescriptive it should be moves. It's not static. And so this is something that came from 1999, a model rule developed that said, you know, we believe centrally this is where you ought to be. But because each agency has unique situations, you can take this as guidance and develop basically what works for your agency. So these things do move over time and become either more restrictive or less restrictive depending upon how much flexibility we want in the system. So I think that may help you. The contracting of representative employees being governed by the contracts and the policies in HR directing the rest of state governments that isn't covered by contract is confusing to people. Now, if that's helpful or not.
You know, I wonder, Representative Butler, let me jump in here for a second. I wonder if it wouldn't be valuable to have the department come back with sort of a cheat sheet, if you will.
A template. Not a cheat sheet.
Okay, template works. of the various manuals that show policies and who they pertain to and what area that pertains to. So, for example, a short description of the Human Resources Services Division's manual, a short description of the Oregon Accounting Manual, a short description of the, what was the other one you talked about?
There was a State Comptroller's Manual, the Human Resource Services Division Manual, also called HR Policy, I think. And then, of course, the Executive Department puts out administrative rules. And I'm just trying to dovetail all of those together to see if we've got a consistent place that a manager of a division in Baker City or in South Portland could go and say, you know, we've got these kinds of issues, or do I flip over to the Robert's Rules of Order on employee recognition and see party is the guidelines.
That's a good point. I would point out the Executive Department in 1993 was extinguished and became part of what is now known as the Department of Administrative Services. You had the General Services Administration and you had the Executive Department, and in 1993, and if I'm not mistaken, it was through Senate Bill 265, the two were merged and created what we now know as the Department of Administrative Services, or DAS. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why, and it was alluded to by Ms. Warner, I think, the last time she was here, that, you know, DAS is sort of this interesting organization because it's neither fish nor fowl. It's, you know, on one side, matter of fact, I've made the comment about DAS being the governor's goons that go and make sure that the agencies behave themselves and do what they're supposed to. But on the other hand, DAS is also a service provider to all of those agencies to provide a litany of services and that sort of thing. And matter of fact, that's one of the things that we're kind of looking at is what those services are, what they're based on, how they're paid for, and then see if there's any further sorts of things that we might want to be either prescribing or suggesting.
Mr. Chair, I just would say this, that if there is a uniform policy and it is changed by notice or by comment, that it be consistent, and that an agency be given every opportunity to comment, large and small agencies both, and that's enough paper to choke a horse at that particular point. But my concern is that if you know, six of these items are either changed or addressed in some fashion each year, and you get a 30 to 60 day comment and public disclosure and opportunity to review those, then virtually all of the time you get somebody within a department trying to examine the rules and regulations, policies, procedures that are being promulgated and passed down.
That's a valid concern.
And it is a valid concern, and as Mr. Radford has indicated, some of those might be two-person agencies, and they don't have, you know, they're just trying to get folks licensed to do the kinds of things that they're supposed to be doing. I want to be cognizant of you know, how we can make these things more efficient. And in that regard, Mr. Chair, we've heard some concerns from the Department of Forestry on their responses. We thought we were doing the right thing. We thought we were following policies and procedures, and then we hear, and this is an issue with regard to audits from the Secretary of State's office. How are we consistently applying these rules when each agency is given a high-level directive, but then are allowed to come back and set up their own policies and procedures. How then does audits, how is it critical when they've extended 5,000 or 10,000 when the procedures and policies are given as general guidelines and Department of Administrative Service really doesn't have any ability to come back and check for uniformity on these issues statewide? Are they in fact being administered statewide? And then, Mr. Chair, as we've gone through this, in some of your discussion of the items that we will be talking about when we make recommendations back to the co-chairs of Ways and Means, we're going to be talking about accounting systems, and I'm very anxious that forestry isn't mandated or directed by the audits committee to go out and change its accounting system. Well, we've got an accounting manual over here that says one thing. LFO may say this is appropriate. Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Divisions may say that's an absolute no. And an audit from the Secretary of State's office may say that's not compatible with what we're willing to go in and supervise relative to an agency audit, the annual audit. So, Mr. Chair, there's a lot of work to be done before we're, and I'm somewhat reticent to come back and be critical of forestry or any other agency that's doing their very best to try and meld all of this together, and then they get caught and get their tail chopped off because what's happened is that they caught the door swinging behind them too close with regard to these rules and regulations. So
sure.
I'm just anxious about that.
Representative Butler pretty well outlined all the confusion there, and then you throw labor contracting on top of it. Man, I don't know how they figure out where they're going.
That's why we're here. It's to help them figure it out. I appreciate that, and that's a very good point. So there are a lot of things at play here. One of the things is nobody said that it would be easy to be an administrator of a department or an agency within the state of Oregon, or probably any state for that matter.
Mr. Chair, can I say something with regard to the issues that we've faced thus far with regard to the Oregon University system? I realize that they have even a greater level of autonomy than forestry may have, and that is, we may want to encourage them to have better accounting systems.
Mm-hmm.
We want to encourage them to have better payroll and employee timekeeping systems and those kinds of things that they, for goodness sakes, implement those kinds of things. I thought through this process that was probably something that we should find in the Oregon accounting manual that would tell them that you'd ought to have an accounting system that would be able to account for these kinds of things, the accounts receivable or the accounts payable. I think John identified the special travel expenses as part of the state controller's manual under the accounts payable. I would have thought that the kinds of recommendations that would be coming from our committee relative to these kinds of functions would have already been addressed somewhere. Maybe as we get ready to make recommendations to the Joint Legislative Audits and the Ways and Means process, Mr. Chair, I'm anxious that these folks weigh in and tell us what they've already done, so we're not plowing new fields.
Sure.
For the first time. This has got to have been covered at some previous time, but then, you know, from my Ways and Means experience, I'm almost shocked at nothing. You'd think that in this process, you'd have an accounting system in an agency that would be uniform with all other agencies. In other words, the accounts receivable, accounts payable functions would be software that would be easily identified, and when there's a glitch in it in Department A, that it changes it and assists in Department A and assists in Department Z as well. The problem that we have is that many of the agencies develop and modify their own software that may not tie together with this
state system. In the past, now I think there's an attempt within budget management to have a one-size-fits-all better accounting system, but in this process, and that's part of Lori's response, I'm sure, here, that we'll get into, that we've got to have some uniformity in this process. If we don't, we can't criticize the legislative fiscal office for its inability to communicate with us in our offices here in the Capitol as to what's happening in Ways and Means. These are the issues that we're going to be discussing in Ways and Means in this particular day, because the budgets, the raw numbers, the accounting, is not available online. It's information that's available. If you'll go down and paw through it, stacks of paper, sheet at a time. And I'm very concerned about that process. That process does not lend itself to transparency. And as you indicated, Mr. Chair, the first step from honesty to dishonesty is opportunity. And when we have a system that is so cumbersome that folks know that it is difficult to translate, to read, to interpret, and we are talking about interpretation of policies and procedures in the same process. And if I'm an employee who used to work for Department A and now work for Department Z, and in Department A they had these policies and procedures in place, I could turn in my reimbursement form for what it is that I thought that I was going to be reimbursed for, and then see myself getting into some kind of a Donnybrook shouting match with my supervisor. And I don't want that kind of an atmosphere. We want to foster the very best atmosphere that we possibly can, because these folks in my department now are saying, wait a minute, we're not going to reimburse you for that. That would be dishonest. And so I'm looking at that and saying, gee, we used to do that in Department A. But that was a policy and procedure over here over which I thought DAS was in kind of control of some degree of uniformity. And we really need that in state government, particularly as we see people moving around from out in the field, into Salem, back out into the field, maybe with different departments, with their skill sets improved each time so that they can move from department to department. There ought to be a tremendous amount of uniformity. We ought to try and do everything we can. I thought that's what the part of the old executive department was, to move it to DAS, to develop this uniformity, seamless accounting, seamless and transparent opportunity to address each of the issues that we're faced with. So,
I think those are very good points, and I think one of the things that will be helpful to us is when we get a sort of the cheat sheet, as I put it, but template, as Representative Butler puts it, is that to be able to look at that and see what sorts of work we can do with the department to help them bring a little bit more uniformity to some of these issues. The other thing is that but to get there, we sort of have to see what's, this is where we're looking under the hood and looking at more, just sort of wiggling the hoses and checking the wires. We're going to be doing a lot more, potentially peeling off the manifold cover and a whole bunch of other things. But I think that getting that template
is the basic elements is what helped me get through chemistry in high school, so it was a template, not a cheat sheet.
There you go. And so I do agree that there probably are conflicting messages that do go out to the departments and figuring out how we make that more uniform. There are also I know it is making sure too that the departments are using the latest version, so that if audits division, for example, is looking at the latest version of the accounting manual, that's in fact what the department is looking at also, so that they know that so there is an understanding of what rules we're playing by. So I think those are some of the things that we will get to. I think the other thing that's going to be helpful, as we've talked about before, is that particularly in the software world, IT suffers very dramatically. IT people suffer from what's known as the NIH syndrome, not invented here syndrome. And I think the consolidation of the data centers is a first step in sort of erasing out some of those lines, because every agency has sort of set up its own little silo with regards to IT. And I think that data center consolidation is the first step to overcoming some of that, so that some of these processes, for example, the state financial management system, being able to make sure that all of the agencies have access to that, making sure that they have access on it to it vis-a-vis the data center. Those types of things, I think, will be real helpful, both to the departments, to the legislature, and to the Department of Administrative Services as they're trying to sort of oversee a lot of these things.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm from House District 60, where we don't have, and it'd be interesting to know how many state employees there were district by district within the state of Oregon. But I would guess that I probably have fewer state employees in House District 60 than would be in either yours or Representative Rosenbaum's district, living in the metropolitan area where there are more services that are provided, or commuting of state employees to the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And so I look at this, and perhaps Representative Rosenbaum, who's smiling at that, would like comment. But I'm anxious for how our constituents are affected by these kinds of things too, because they need to know that there's a level playing field, that the rules and regulations and policies are not loosely administered, that there is a agency which checks for oversight, that an audit function within HRSD is uniformly applied statewide, and not just when we have somebody that seems to be in trouble. I'm anxious about that, the perception that we go out and beat people up with ancient history because of evolving accounting rules. And it's not fair to the Secretary of State's audit division either, in that process, to be auditing with what they thought were the rules for 2004, when maybe they're using a 2004 manual, when really the issues that are being applied by the agency are the 2003 rules at that particular point. And, sure. And what's the evolution of that process? So I just would like to have Lori and John Radford and others from the office tell us that there will be consistently applied rules, and that they'll be uniform from agency to agency as much as possible within the collective bargaining agreements that there are that would cover, I guess, various agencies. Each agency may, I think there's several, 13 different bargaining groups or something of that, 12 or 13 as I recall.
Mr. Chair, maybe we can close on this and
yes, I think that would be it.
With, you know, the centralized systems that DAS run are standardized, and the agencies use those. So it's not that they're out each doing their own thing in that respect. I think the policies and the application in each agency will vary some. And when they get, you know, you get 100% compliance all the time with the rules, you probably won't. You know, are you within 90%, you know, for some rules that works, for others you need the 100%. And so you're always within those ranges. And when the audits show that they're outside of those ranges very significantly, then we as a state have issues. And I think that's what the audit functions do, both in Human Resource Services, Secretary of State, internal auditors. They try to make sure that we're staying within the boundaries. And so I think that DAS has those standardized systems and processes, but when you're implementing across 100 agencies, there's going to be variations, and you try to keep those in check.
Okay, let's go ahead and move on, because we're going to run out of time. And
we have till 10:30, is that?
Yes, we have until 10:30.
Okay. Let me start through this, then. You should have a packet in front of you, and I'm going to... this is the memo that I'm going to start talking to you from. Okay. It's in the front. And then there are attachments that are going to be referred to as we go through this.
Okay.
So one of the first questions you had was about the history of DAS. And, Mr. Chair, you just spoke to that a little bit. Following the 93 session, the Department of General Services, and Dan Simmons was the director, and the Executive Department with Fred Miller as the director, were merged in anticipation of savings derived from central internal operations. That created what we know today as the Department of Administrative Services. So that's basically over 10 years now that occurred. And the department is located in several different areas of the mall here and in the cities where we have motor pools. So let me kind of talk about that. The director's office for the department, as well as the budget management division, human resource services division, state controller division, and our business office is located in the executive building that's referred to right across from the Capitol over here, across the park. The public employees benefit board, which does the health benefit bargaining, is located right across from the mall on the side over here on Court Street by the Presbyterian Church. It's kind of a low-level office building. They're located in there. The Information Resource Management Division, State Services Division, and Facilities are located in over by Ferry Street behind those businesses, just directly behind State Street across the tracks. There's a kind of gray building there, and the steam plant is across with the tower, the old steam plant. In addition to that, we manage the Burns Archive Center, which is out in Burns, Oregon, built some time ago. That's where IRMD, where the archiving functions for the state reside, as well as the lottery office backup center. And then the DAS operates three motor pools, one in Eugene, Springfield, one in Salem, and one in Portland at Swan Island. So we have multiple locations. You had asked in the org charts that we take these divisions, the eight divisions we have, and you had asked for a disaggregated organizational chart, and you'd also asked for employees underneath those charts. So your attachment one, I'm not going to go through all these pages, but this is the first cover sheet, for example, is the office of the director, so you see the organizational chart. The next pages that follow are the budgeted dollars for each of those positions on the org chart. And then the last page is because on your printout, which is a computer printout, you're going to have a code on there that tells you under class and comp what the position number is, but not the title of the position. So really the last page is an index so that you can say a position that Z7016 is a principal executive manager I, and the computer printouts can't tell you that. That's the very first position on the stripe sheets, and that's just the index, so you know what the titles of the positions are.
Okay.
So this just goes through by division and does that for each one of our divisions. That gives you an idea of what the positions are and what the budgeted dollars are. Those are documents that are in our Ways and Means materials that the Ways and Means Committee has. The number of employees in the DAS budget for 05-07 is 885. You had asked about that. And the total operating budget is $534 million. The next piece was the budget questions that you had. The DAS budget, remember we talked about pie charts when I was here before about how we're funded, assessment fees, that sort of thing. And what kind of funding do we have? General fund, federal fund, other funds, and lottery funds. So attachment two, go to that page, basically is a narrative that describes for you under the first line in the middle of the page, DAS 0507 price list assessments. This is the assessment dollars for the agency. And remember, the fee revenues were more than the assessment revenues on the pie chart. But this tells you for each one of the divisions what kind of assessment they have and what the assessment's based on. And so there's two pages of that. If you move to the third page of that handout, attachment two, these are the services where the charges are based on the amount of utilization. So we set a fee in the price list, and the amount that an agency will spend in each one of these categories will vary depending on how much they use that service, because this is what we call fee for services. And that goes on for two pages. Then there's the miscellaneous other fund revenues, like where DAS passes $3 to counties, or tobacco, for example, the tobacco settlement fund distribution. We're just a pass-through agency for those. There's the bond debt service to pay off the payroll system charges through the agencies, the pension on the pension bonds. So there's just a list of a bunch of miscellaneous things, revenues that pass through our agency. And then on the last page, we talk about what is general fund, which you folks are familiar with. Who's it going to in our department? It's going to health policy research, economic analysis, and the bond payments. The federal money is really receipts from the national forest products, and we're distributing those to the counties. And then the lottery fund is where we provide the payments out to the various entities that are receiving the lottery funds. So that's a breakdown of those categories to answer those questions that you had about what that looked like. And then there was a question on non-restricted funds. And basically, we need to, I'm on the second page of the narrative handout, the overview. The non-restricted fund, and we weren't certain exactly what this meant to you, but basically, DAS, we build the fee revenue and the assessments ahead of the budget process. And so we're anticipating what we're going to be spending and what agencies are going to be asking for ahead of the budget process. And then those are built into agency budgets as they make their agency requests to the governor, and then the governor budget moves forward to you. Those are estimates at the time. Now, as we go through the biennium, if we see, for example, that one kind of category of service that we're providing, like fleet rental, for example, for day trip cars, if agencies are using a lot more of those services than what we anticipated, and, you know, we have fixed costs and variable costs, but we would be finding perhaps that we have more revenue there than we need to cover expenses, we have in the past adjusted rates downward in the middle of the biennium so that we don't accumulate a lot of ending balance. The goal for us within the department is not to have more than 30 to 60 day cash ending balance within the various functions we operate. So that's when you're asking about non-restricted funds, all of the funds that come into DAS are for a specific fee or service or assessment that's being charged. So there isn't anything that's just without a cause, I guess I would say. And we try to monitor where we are with the revenues and the expenditures so that we know if we're over-collecting in an area, and then we return those funds by lowering rates, essentially, is how we do it. Basically, you ask, are all agencies assessed the same amount during the biennium, and can the fees be reduced? And I just answered that question for you. You ask about uniform rent and how it's calculated, and my understanding is that you're going to have Bill Foster come back and actually have a session with you on uniform rent. So yes. I think that could take, you know, a half an hour or an hour discussion in and of itself on uniform rent, so you'd probably be better served by that. The budget information.
Lori, mm-hmm. Let me back up for just a second. With regards to the price list, in the handout here, is the price list by any chance in here?
You didn't ask for that, but we certainly can send that to you.
I would appreciate it if you would provide us with the price list.
Would you like that electronically, or you want it hard copy? You want a hard copy for your notebook?
Yeah. If you could provide it hard copy so we can add it to our notebook, that would be terrific.
Okay. Budget information on the internet was one of the questions about which agencies post and which agencies don't. They're not required at this point to post it, but we did survey the agencies, and on page 3, you'll see that there's a list of the agencies that have the 0507 governor's recommended budget, and then the agencies that display the 0305 legislatively approved. There's only two of those. And then there's agencies with a summary of the 0305 legislatively approved budget. And then the other folks responded that they didn't have budget information out there. So you can see that breakdown. There was a question about the Oregon Budget Information Tracking System, ORBITS, which is what you were referring to, I think, Representative Butler earlier, about linking the budget expenditures and the accounting expenditures together. And there's a package in the DAS budget being considered for continual development of that functionality so that you have real-time data available, accounting expenditures against the budget. And that's been under development between Department Administrative Service and the Legislative Fiscal Office for the last two biennium, so that we get that connected, and it, then you can more easily see what's happening with the budgets.
Sure. Representative Butler, thank you. Lori,
your question. Oh, excuse me.
Excuse me, Lori. Let me just ask you a question about the orbits and the ability for real-time access and information. We can't access information real-time in the budget process from the legislature other than going to Legislative Fiscal, and Legislative Fiscal can communicate with your office and either have it brought over hard copy or sent over electronically, and then we can take a look at some of the information after it's sent over electronically. How many states have a transparent system that is accessible and viewable by the public? You know that. Here comes John. He's going to help bail me out here. So I just wondered, is Oregon in the implementation over the last 4 years of orbits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think, you know, John will answer here more specifically because he is involved in the national level for the state controllers. You know, the states have all moved a significant number are making efforts to move to more transparency and budget with the public. And you see Washington State did that. Oregon did that this time around. So are we good at it yet? Probably not. We're working at it. The internal tool, though, is what the Orbitz project and the statewide financial management system project and linking those together is, so that our technical people on staff have access to that and can be informed by it, and that it becomes more easily usable as a tool, management tool. But let me have John.
John Radford again, State Controller's Division, Department of Administrative Services. Representative Butler and Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the statewide accounting system has what is known as a data warehouse. And that data warehouse is a cost-effective box that sits on the internet and is accessible uniformly across state government electronically. And the state accounting system was crafted in such a way as to minimize transaction costs. And so that's kind of a transaction engine, if you will, that feeds the general ledger. That data is taken off of the mainframe and deposited weekly onto a server that sits on the internet and is accessible by all agencies, including LFO and anybody on the legislative staff. We control security on that. We open that to anyone. And all they need to do is have a little instruction on the data structure, and then they can use almost any, there's some 2,000 or 3,000, what they call, and I don't know, this is an acronym, but I don't know exactly what it means, ODBC, Object Database Compliant Software, I think. And that allows you to access it, our data, and it's 1 week old. We do this weekly because it's costly to download. So it's a week old. But it's on the net, and anybody can use software tools such as Microsoft Excel, Access, Brio. We particularly like a Brio tool. Brio is a brand software tool. It's a query and reporting software tool. There's others, Cognos, Crystal Reports. So you need to know a little bit about how that Access tool works. We give you security, you access our database, and you can cut and slice and download the data to your heart's content.
Mr. Chair. If I may, to Mr. Radford, so that is presently available to LFO and to all members of the Legislative Assembly?
Yes, sir.
How many members of the Legislative Assembly have actually downloaded the software and have the access codes provided?
I don't believe there's anyone from the legislature, members, that have obtained electronic access to that software. There may be one or two in the LFO department that has. I'm not sure. But certainly any agency has access to their data electronically. They can download. They can redo the reports. It's a very cost-effective way to get online access to the data. We have a BRIO users group across the state government that share queries and share a library of queries. So if somebody isn't quite familiar with how to download and access data, they can go to some other agency. This is the report I want, or this is the way I want to look at the data. I can take your query, make a few changes to my agency, press the button and run the query, and the report will come back electronically.
So if I could follow up,
sure.
So agencies, and Laurie, you mentioned 100 agencies. Agencies have the ability to do this. And legislators have the ability to do it by giving the proper code and the security clearance and then the training. But zero legislators, is that right? But how many of the 100 agencies are actually querying and producing and massaging the information?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Butler, I think the majority of state agencies, the vast majority of state agencies, are using that tool. In the past, for example, we've heard stories about how an agency might get a request at a Ways and Means Committee for a particular stream of information or data, and it would literally take them 4 to 6 weeks to acquire that information, going through a mainframe reporting tool, having programmers program the report, that kind of thing, and they'll get it in 2 or 3 hours using this tool. And then multiple iterations, what ifs? What if we change that parameter and we get the data a little differently, that kind of thing. And it's vastly improved decision-making and decision sciences across the state agencies by having this kind of access and flexibility in terms of a tool to download that information and to manipulate it for decision-making purposes.
Follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So LFO actually is using this for loading financial statements at this point?
Representative Butler, members of the committee, I'm not exactly sure who has authorization from LFO, but we've certainly extended that to them, and they can certainly take advantage of it. They can, if they understand a little bit about the agency's structure, program and organization structure, a little bit about how the data is organized, and then they have some familiarity with the tool that they're using, we can connect that tool to the data, and they can start querying and downloading information.
But of the vast majority, again using your term there, John, of the vast majority of agencies who have access and training, they're accessing it on a regular basis. They've been trained and accessing on a regular basis. They can only access their information. They can access all state government information.
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, members of the committee, they can only access their information on that agency. But certainly we can give others who have a need to know cross-agency information access. Like, for example, members of my staff, they have cross-agency information. We can query the entire state.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm uncomfortable with the needs-to-know basis. This is the financial information of the people. And I'm kind of anxious about that.
Representative Butler and Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we feel that exactly the same way. This is public information and we'll make it available. We're just not going to make it available to just anybody. There needs to be some kind of review. There needs to be some kind of security around that.
That's the data mart really is the after the fact expenditure data for the agency, whereas the Orbitz project and the connection with statewide financial systems is a different type of project, different purposes. So there are two tools that we're really talking about, two different tools here. I'm going to move on to the next question on your list was that, and I'm on page 4 at the top, agencies that contract with DAS for accounting and budgeting services, you had that question. So on attachment 3, there's the list, and these folks reside in the State Controller's Division. They work for John Radford's group. And this is just the name of the person, his staff person, and each of the agencies that they currently provide services to under attachment 3. You would also ask about which agencies have internal auditors and which don't. And so what we've got under attachment 4 is a listing of the agencies that have internal auditors, and whether those positions, the first column is fiscal year 2004 filled positions, the ones that were vacant, and in the next column, and those agencies that are going to contract out for audit services, not necessarily have someone on their staff, and then agencies that are undecided whether to contract or fill their positions. So that's a listing by each of the agencies. The next question that you had asked about were capital construction projects, and where we were in pending projects and what the 0507 budget looked like. The capital improvement projects, capital improvement expenditures have six-year lives because capital construction projects that are started this biennium may not be finished in one biennium. So there is currently about $21 million, and that's under attachment 4 here, that shows you, or excuse me.
Attachment 6.
It's attachment 6. That shows the projects that are currently under work right now and that will not be fully expended. This is the amount that won't be expended by the end of this biennium. And then the budget for 0507, there's capital improvement budget, which stays pretty much the same between the bienniums, and then the capital construction request that we have in for this biennium is also under that same attachment, and it shows you what the projects are that the Ways and Means committees will be considering for funding for this coming 0507 biennium. So there's a listing of all of those projects. The next question you had asked about was, what customer service functions does DAS provide to agencies? And so basically, the statewide services that we provide, there's a listing of what the policy offices do. First of all, Office of Economic Analysis and the Progress Board. They do the economic forecast and the performance measurement. The Internal Audit Group, of course, leads the reviews of kind of state agency management reviews that go on where we have problems in agencies, as well as do our own internal audit function and do the statewide coordination with Secretary of State and the Legislative Audit Committee. Budget management work, I think you're pretty familiar with in terms of those services from the Budget Management Division. Information Resource Management Division has both a leadership role and then a service role in terms of providing computer and networking infrastructure for the state, as well as the telephone and data communications. Human Resource Services does the statewide personnel system, maintains all of the employee records. And then I'm moving to page 5, where you have the State Controller Division, and we've just talked about the accounting functions. Then the direct services that we provide to agencies under Facilities Division, that's who builds, manages, and maintains all of the buildings and the leases for state agencies. Purchasing and fleet and surplus property, this is the group that does buying and purchasing and has those systems that service state agencies as well as local government. The fleet services manages the three motor pools, and surplus manages the reuse and disposable of state property, office-type property. Risk management provides the training for and the insurance fund for the risk pool for the state, and the Public Employees Benefit Board designs and maintains and administers the health insurance plans. You asked about the projects that utilize a DAS project manager. Project manager certification began in 1998 so that we had competent people trained to manage these multi-million dollar projects that we're operating. We use project managers on all the information resource management as well as facility division projects. And here's a list of the current projects that have project managers for you, and then the recently finished projects that were completed in this biennium. On the last page, next last page, you asked about methods utilized to determine cost savings. These are some examples. There's projects where there are costs that are hard dollars, and there's projects that are more soft dollars that are harder to, you have savings, but they're harder to articulate. So I'm just going to talk about two examples here. On strategic sourcing, that's the Oregon Smart Buy program. That's a project that we began this biennium to look at how we're purchasing goods and services for the state and how to get the best financial deal that we can for the state. We expect to save in this project about $10 million this biennium. There's a package in our budget for next biennium that would continue a second phase of this and identify other project work that would be done, other areas where we think that we have leverage and we can save additional dollars. Now, when we do that, understand that we get pushback from the vendor community because we're asking them to give us better prices and we're negotiating a harder deal. So that's currently underway. Those dollars are being tracked. If I move down to the PEB, Public Employees Benefit Board Administration on the bottom, you can see they've done some small things, which all of our divisions do over time, like consolidate storage units, switch from printed newsletters to electronic, reduce dues and subscriptions. So those are small dollar savings. They've also, under open enrollment, they have gone to teleconferences and video exchange of information using the web, going from a paper application for health insurance to doing that online on the web. So those are harder to capture in terms of knowing what we've saved, but those are examples of the kind of things that we do.
Lori, can I just ask one question relative sure. to the strategic sourcing and Smart Buy Orient, or mm-hmm. Orient Smart Buy? I realize that when items are bid on the various functions of state government and purchasing, that other agencies within the state have the ability to buy on those same bids. Is that correct?
Yes, that's the intent, is that we marshal all of our buying power together. So yes.
In that process, are the 9 federally recognized tribes given that same opportunity to participate?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, Representative Butler, but we'll get back to you. The counties and cities buy off of that.
I recognize the counties and cities
I don't know about
this question came to me this weekend
okay.
as I was taking a look at one of the tribal facilities south of here on I-5 and
yeah.
and those folks have been very resourceful.
Yes.
And my concern is that if we don't make certain that uh-huh. the 9 federally recognized tribes have an opportunity to come with us and participate,
yeah.
then pretty soon they're going to be bidding on some of these projects. We're going to have to be buying from them.
Could so be. But we should, we'll look.
Yeah,
we'll see what that would think.
I can get a response to that. Thank you.
The next question was the square footage of the state-owned property and lease from the private sector. You know, DAS is one of 6 major property-owning agencies, not counting the university system, because the university system owns the most property in the state. But if you look at other state agencies like ODOT, Forestry, Parks, DAS is in that group. We own about 21% of the 3.2 million square feet of the state's 14 million of the buildings. And we lease about 4 million. So we own 3.2 million and we lease 4 million from the private sector. That was, I think you wanted to know that background. And then the last question you asked was about DAS audits and a list of them linked to the web pages. And I would tell you that on the very last page, there's one report on the State of Oregon Comprehensive Financial Report that isn't on the webs. And we've included a summary under Attachment 5 in here. Okay. So you can read it. If you need more information on that particular audit, we can get you the detail. But the summary is in there. So I think that was the list of your questions that you had wanted answers to.
Okay. I apologize, Lori, for keeping so long on those other two issues that we kind of rushed.
Those infrastructure issues, though, are important, and people's understanding of them, the state government and how agencies use our systems. So
right.
I think a worthwhile conversation.
Yes, I agree. I think what I'd like to do is, first of all, are there any questions?
No.
Representative Butler, do you have any questions? What I think I'd like to do is we'll take a little time to kind of digest some of the information that you've provided us. And then if we have sort of further specific questions, we can, I assume, schedule to have you come back and and give us some more information about those functions and those things.
Okay.
That would be terrific. Thank you.
Good enough. You're welcome.
There's not anything else, members, then we will go ahead and stand adjourned for the day, and we'll see you on Thursday.